This is a podcast from WILL AM 580. To support our station, please visit www.willpledge.org. That's www.willpledge.org.
This is AM 580 News Daily Podcast for June 30th. I'm Michael Kuliska. Coming up, after the flood, living along the Mississippi River, and another edition of Legal Issues, Amy Guider will look at the United States Supreme Court decision on Washington, D.C.'s gun control law. And AM 580 meteorologist Scott Alford will check the forecast, but first, a look at today's news. When Illinois starts the new fiscal year tomorrow, without the budget in place, few will notice much difference. But as Sean Crawford reports, the public should be concerned.
State government will continue working tomorrow uninterrupted in almost all areas. Yet storm clouds are on the horizon. An ongoing budget battle between Governor Rod Blagojevich and House Speaker Mike Madigan, both Democrats, has agencies and those who rely on state funds holding on for what could be a white-knuckle ride this summer. Blagojevich says the budget lawmakers approve spends $2 billion more than it brings in. He's vowed to rein in that spending with big cuts to human services and other areas. That is, unless Madigan agrees to raise revenue through more casinos and borrowing money. Blagojevich could take his time in an attempt to build pressure on the House. The state constitution gives him nearly 2 months in which to act. But with the state unable to pay bills and employees, problems could begin appearing as early as next week. So while tomorrow could seem like any other day in state government, if the budget rift continues much longer, the impact will become very noticeable. I'm Sean Crawford.
House member Naomi Jacobson says the next move is up to Blagojevich. The Urbana Democrat said last week that the governor's list of possible spending cuts is too vague. Jacobson says the House can respond to them until Blagojevich sent lawmakers a specific list of potential cuts.
As far as the legislature goes, we did give the governor a budget, and he's the one who's holding up the deadlines now.
Jacobson also defends House Speaker Michael Madigan from Republican criticism that he's failed to meet with the governor or other legislative leaders on the budget. She says Madigan has kept the process going by sending staff members and other high-ranking House members to budget meetings in his place. Governor Rod Blagojevich today plans to sign legislation to continue Illinois' early childhood program, Preschool for All. The governor is slated to sign the measure during an appearance in Chicago today with the head of the Illinois State Board of Education, State Representative Barbara Flynn Curry, and other leaders. Illinois State Senator Christine Rodonia is now one of several Republicans eyeing the governor's seat in 2010. She says Democratic control of state politics has left a fiscal mess she's compelled to clean up. But Rodonia says the biggest obstacle to a bid may come from her own party.
The one thing that will become obvious is the Republicans have struggled over time with different factions in the party. And I think our only hope of getting a Republican elected is to come together around a candidate.
Rodonia has represented part of Chicago's southwestern suburbs in the Illinois Senate since 1997. She says she won't make a firm decision about running until the 2008 election is over. Floodwaters will suck billions of dollars out of the Midwest's economy, though probably not as much as the 1993 flooding that devastated the region. Federal and state agricultural officials say the real damage won't be known until after the fall harvest. A report due today from the Department of Agriculture should give the country its first glimpse of damage to the corn and soybean crops. The Indiana Agriculture Department says 10% of the state's corn and soybean crops has been damaged by rain and floods. In Iowa, 8% of the 13 million acres of U.S. Department of Agriculture anticipated would be planted in corn is flooded. Indiana officials estimate this state's losses at $800 million, and the Farm Bureau pegs Iowa's losses alone at roughly $3 billion. Experts say it's too soon to even estimate the losses in Illinois and Missouri, which also are big corn and soybean-growing states. State and environmental officials are trying to determine if the release of toxins from a wastewater lagoon at the Pfizer drug plant near Terre Haute has contaminated drinking water or soil. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management began investigating the release of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, on June 7th, after workers reported a breach in a dam on the lagoon from heavy rains and flooding. PCBs once were used in a variety of U.S. products, including paints, plastics, and rubber materials. pigments and dyes, and as coolants and lubricants and electrical, heat transfer and hydraulic equipment. The federal government banned the manufacture of PCBs in 1977 because of studies showing a number of serious health effects related to exposure to them. A PHMSA spokesman says the company is working with both environmental management officials to take whatever steps are needed. For the latest newscast online, go to will.uiuc.edu/news. This is AM 580 News Daily Podcast. I'm Michael Kuliska. The Mississippi River is gradually returning to normal levels in western Illinois, but for many people who live along the river, the story of the Great Flood of 2008 is far from over, Rich Egger reports.
Residents of the region's small river towns gather at Haggy's Place in Dallas City for a steak or fish dinner that comes with a baked potato and green beans, where dessert choices include peach cobbler and cheesecake with cherry topping. Jamie Williams is here, explaining how one day earlier she returned to her home in Pontusic's flooded Rio Vista subdivision for the first time in nearly 2 weeks.
I put the key in the door and I just kind of stood there and I was like, I wanted to open it up and go in, but then I didn't really want to because I was scared what I was going to find out. And I opened the door and I kind of just peeked in there, and then I seen it was dry in the main part of the house, and then I was like, ah!
However, her home did not escape unscathed. She says the river flooded her laundry room where the floor buckled. Williams and her husband moved to Rio Vista shortly before the Great Flood of 1993, so she's been through this before. This time, though, she's dealing with the flooding without her husband by her side. He died last year. Nonetheless, she's not completely on her own.
We have a really good group of people that live down there right now. You know, and everybody looks out for everybody down there. That's just...
like our Rio Vista area is further down.
This is Pontusic Village President Bob Durand.
When you drive through town, you might stop 5-6 times and talk to this one and talk to that one because, like I say, we're all friends. We know each other. We've all, you know, lived together.
Durand has been village president for 23 years, so he's been through this before, too. Durand says 98 Pontusic homes sit in the floodplain. Some were elevated after the flood of 93 and remained dry this year, but more than 50 other homes were flooded. Durand hopes more residents will now elevate their houses. He thinks future floods are possible because levees are being built higher and higher along the Mississippi.
And it's just squeezing a river in and it just can't hold the water. Nobody would have thought that we would have had one 15 years after 93 like this. But you just can't take care of Mother Nature. I mean, it's going to do its thing.
The roads in Pontusic remain wet. Parts are covered with a slimy mud. From the back seat of a car, Jamie Williams looks out at the community she calls home.
It makes me want to cry. I mean, it's so sad. You know, I mean, just look at the grass, how it's brown, it's muddy, it's almost devastating to think, you know, just 3 weeks ago, we had nice green grass, everybody's homes was nice, and now, I mean, everything down here is destroyed, it looks like. The current was very, very strong through here.
There's nothing really to hold it back, is there?
No. On Friday the 13th, when I drove my four-wheeler out of here through it at 10:30, I have a Honda 680, which sits up pretty high, and I had water halfway up over my knee trying to get it out of here.
Near the road into Pontusic, Margie Anderson and others sit at a few picnic tables waiting for the Red Cross to deliver sandwiches and water. Anderson grew up in Pontusic, then lived elsewhere for many years before returning 5 years ago with her husband, Bob. The house they live in was raised just enough after 93 to remain dry this year. Still, it was surrounded by water, so they relied on others to get in and out.
I call them water taxis. We had about eight boats out here. A lot of these guys are hunters and fishermen, and so we relied on them to take us back and forth. So It was like kind of like Venice around here. Not as fancy as boat, though.
There's nothing fancy about the food and water brought in by the Red Cross, but the stuff is important. A helping hand is still needed for the people who live here, people who are now working to get their homes back in order and their lives back to normal. Rich Egger reporting.
And it's time for another edition of Legal Issues. The United States Supreme Court decided late last week that Washington, D.C.'s gun control law was an unconstitutional restriction on the right to bear arms. But even though the court's decision has been called landmark, it's not the first time a court has faced the issue. Commentator Amy Guider takes us back to 1822 in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
So let's say that it's around the year 1820, as in nearly 200 years ago, and you're a guy living in Kentucky. You dress to impress with a stylish cane, a cane with a sword hidden inside it, the sort of weapon one might see today in a museum in France or in some outlandish spy film from the 1960s. Such was the burden of a man named Bliss back then. Mr. Bliss asked the Court of Appeals of Kentucky to do something about the state's nasty concealed arms statute, one that prohibited any person from wearing a pocket pistol, dirk, large knife, or sword in a cane concealed as a weapon unless traveling on a journey, one that he and his cane had been convicted of violating. After all, such restrictive language, Bliss argued, directly conflicted with the state constitutional right given citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state. It's not precisely the case decided by the United States Supreme Court last week. The case of the cane, after all, hinged on the Kentucky Constitution, not the Second Amendment to the federal Constitution. But Mr. Bliss was among the very first litigants to point the way toward an expansive reading of constitutional gun rights. He convinced the Kentucky court in 1822 that it violated the state constitution to restrict weaponry in any way. Check out this language. "It is the right to bear arms in defense of the citizens and the state that is secured by the Constitution, and whatever restrains the full and complete exercise of that right, though not an entire destruction of it, is forbidden by the explicit language of the Constitution. And, in principle, there is no difference between a law prohibiting the wearing of concealed arms and a law forbidding the wearing such as are exposed. And if the former be unconstitutional, the latter must be so likewise. Oh, happy day. Or should I say, oh, happy couple of decades, depending upon your home state and your point of view. Bliss got his wish, but by the 1840s, not all courts would embrace his choice of walking/slashing implement and his home court's expansive reading of the right to bear arms provision. In Alabama, the state's highest court found it perfectly constitutional to ban the evil practice of concealed weapons, interpreting its own constitutional language to allow the legislature's restrictive actions. Tennessee's highest court, too, worried early on that without legislative bans on certain weaponry, including Bowie knives, citizens, especially assassins and robbers, would keep and bear such arms only for private boils. It found that the state's constitutional right to bear arms clause was not unlimited. It probably didn't help that one of the defendants in the case had threatened that he would have his enemy's heart's blood. But back to Kentucky. Nearly 190 years after his successful court fight, Bliss found his way out of obscurity last week. His case, his name, is mentioned in a footnote on page 15 of the Supreme Court's opinion, and you can bet that Mr. Bliss would be pleased that his case was cited by the majority and not the dissent. Oh, and Bliss's sword and a cane weapon? Its nattiness is still available online. With great foresight, one seller suggests in a link titled Legal Stuff that today's Bliss's check with their local police department, or better yet, their lawyer, to find out what's allowed and what isn't under the law. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. And we take a look at the weather. Meteorologist Scott Althoff says a mix of sun and possible rain is in the forecast for Champaign, Urbana, and the area. Today, partly to mostly sunny with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high 80 degrees, the wind from the northwest 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tonight mostly clear, the low 55, the wind from southwest at 3 to 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny, the high 84, the wind from the southwest 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear skies, the low 63 degrees. Wednesday, mostly sunny, the high near 90 degrees. Wednesday night, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. the low of 66 degrees. And Thursday, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. This has been the AM580 News Daily Podcast for June 30th, 2008. You can find podcasts of Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, agriculture programming, as well as other helpful information at our website, will.uiuc.edu. I'm Michael Kuliska, AM580 News.